Okay, so I'm really honoured to be asked. I've always been a little bit intimidated by the Dominicans because you're all so clever and very well read and learned, and I'm not a theologian and sort of feel a bit of an interloper in this space. So I am really very honoured to be asked. And I've got many Dominican friends, actually. I think Father Sam was the first, about 10 years ago, and Sister Helen Alford is also a friend, and anyway, numerous others. So it's wonderful to be here, and well, I've been asked to talk about our Christian calling in the context of this historical moment. And so we're going to look at what's going on. We're going to read the signs of the times. We're going to look at what's happened to our culture and why. We're going to try and name reality, honestly. And we're going to use Catholic social teaching to do that. And also to show how the teaching tradition will help us to respond and be part of the antidote. And we're also going to look at how God is calling each one of us to be more intentionally relational in order to participate in his mission. Not as some grand strategy, but as our everyday Christian witness. So the title of this session is Our Calling and the Relational Imperative. But before we get to the imperative, we've got to understand why the relational is imperative. And I want to start, if I may, just with a phrase that I really like, vocational responsibility. Now, I've kind of appropriated this from Pope John Paul II, who often spoke about responsibility arising from one's vocation. And obviously, you here will know that only too well in terms of the priesthood and the religious life. And those of us who are married will understand that from the marriage vocation too. But of course, everyone also is called to participate in God's great creative participation, our contribution to the world as a gift. And John Paul spoke of vocation not just in terms of individuals, but also in terms of institutions, local institutions, businesses, schools, churches, charities, associations, all have a vocation for the common good. So we'll look at that a bit more later on, but the point being that vocation is not inward looking, it's outward facing. And the responsibility arising from our vocation applies to all of us. So with that backdrop, I think it's probably a good idea if I tell you a little bit about myself, so you know where I'm coming from. I had an Anglican upbringing. I am the only daughter of Bishop David Shepherd, who in his partnership with Archbishop Warlock was involved in a sort of groundbreaking partnership between the 70s and the 90s. At a time of division, high unemployment, instability, sectarianism, they embodied solidarity and they were taken to the hearts of the people of Liverpool. And of course their ministry bridged the sectarian divide. It was an example of relational leadership. Their relationship directly led to the historic visit of John Paul II in 1982. Without their relationship, that probably wouldn't have happened. And it was the first visit of a reigning pope since the Reformation. So it was a symbolic healing moment that came out of that relationship. But I wasn't happy being a bishop's daughter. I was actually quite a nightmare as a teen. And if any of you are teachers here, I was the sort of teen that you'd have been worried about. I was happier in the Liverpool music scene. I was estranged from the church. But then, years later, in my 20s, I had a conversion experience, a dark night of the soul, a very dramatic experience, an unexpected grace, completely out of the blue, really. And I became a Catholic under the guidance of Father Michael Hollings. I developed a prayer life. I was just working as a graphic designer, a bit of charity work. I got married, I had children. So for about 20 years, quite an unremarkable, quiet life, very much very ordinary. And then in 2011, in my late 40s, I had what I would describe as a nudge of the Holy Spirit. I didn't really understand, didn't have the language to describe what was going on at that time, but I sensed something was happening. And what I was seeing was, I was kind of being drawn to see the beginnings of things going wrong in our society. It was 2011, you might remember the Tottenham riots, beginning of public discontent. What's now very obvious to everyone, I think, was beginning then. I was seeing that the politics of left and right was failing to meet real needs. And I was particularly noticing that the churches were unable to respond adequately. And at that point, as I was on this trail, somebody introduced me to Catholic social teaching. Now, I've been Catholic since 1988 and no one had told me about it. So as Father Nick implies, you know, a lot of people regard it as optional or, you know, not central. So at that point, I'm not an academic and I struggled. It's quite dense, but I immediately realised it was dynamic and really vitally important, but inaccessible, abstract and dry, the way it was being communicated. Anyway, I continued following this trail of discernment and I was introduced to people. And over about a year, I met about 100 people. Eventually, this emerged into what I now run, which is Together for the Common Good, a small charity. We're still very spirit-led. Thousands have become involved over those years. And we help people build up confidence to discern they are called to play a part for the common good. They have a vocational responsibility. And so we engage with churches, charities, leaders and schools. We produce online resources. We hold public talks on the big questions of our time. We produce a podcast and we have a schools program. I'll tell you more about that at the end of the session. But essentially it's about confidence building and formation, particularly around becoming relational. So in all of this journey, I just try to follow what the Lord is asking of me. It wasn't my idea. You did not choose me, I chose you. That's very much how it feels. So let me just say what we mean by the common good before we go any further. Because often, I mean, many of you are scholars, so you'll all have your intellectual idea of what the common good is, and in wider society, people have an idea of what it is. It can tend to mean something quite woolly. People think it's a bit vague. And of course, the classic definition from Gaudium et Spes is the sum total of social conditions that allow people, either as groups or as individuals, to reach their fulfillment more fully and more easily. But for me, that's, again, it's a bit dry, you know, it's a bit abstract. So the common good is not an outcome that can be imposed from above. It's not something that a government can create. It's not utopian. It can't be engineered technocratically. It emerges from people being together. There's something of a mystery about it that comes from the transcendent nature of human beings. And it comes through their free participation. If you had to boil it down, you'd probably talk about a shared life, a life that is shared. And it's shared across difference, class, ethnicity, opinion, age. And it requires dialogue. It requires deliberation, listening, negotiation, forgiveness, forbearance. Many of you in a community will understand what that means. And it's not easy. It's not sentimental. Sometimes it has to be negotiated hard. If you're thinking about building a common good between business and unions, for example, you may have to negotiate the interests that are at play there. You're thinking about negotiating a common good around immigration. You would have to take into account the interests of the host communities and the people who are travelling to a new country. And you work out a balance of interests. But also, we could think of it in a more innocuous sense, but a more joyful sense. Like a choir, very much like your voices singing just now. Many different voices contributing, where everybody has a different role to play, but the collective experience is transforming and benefits everyone. So the question becomes, why is this so urgent now? So I think we're going to read the signs of the times. course, I think it was Hemingway that said, change happens slowly and then all at once. And it does feel like that kind of moment, doesn't it? It's been building for a number of years. As Father Nick said yesterday, that was that Pope Francis quote, which we're not just in the era of change, but a change of era. Now, that's not just rhetoric. It is actually the case. And that's really hard for us to get our heads around. And Pope Francis described this as a process of being stripped of false securities, that we're no longer able to complacently enjoy the illusions of the old era. It's not credible anymore to continue with the assumption even that governments can adequately represent us, or that the socioeconomic model that we've been living with can underwrite a flourishing life for all. And that feels deeply unsettling. That is actually what's going on. So we're seeing lots of symptoms. We're seeing, of course, extreme inequality, estrangement between different groups, the commodification of creation. We're seeing war, displacement of people. We're seeing the extreme liberalisation of abortion, of assisted suicide, a profound shift in the idea of what human dignity means. And we're seeing the young in particular manifesting symptom pathologies, symptoms of distress, depression, self-harm, yearning for meaning, addiction to social media, profound loneliness. Loneliness much worse among the young than the old, in fact. And we're seeing the digital space, the new digital revolution, is really threatening what we understand to be our physical reality, our relationship with place, particularly in poor communities. You know, if you've got very poor infrastructure, you can understand why it's very tempting to go online where life is shiny and perfect. So there's a real threat to our engagement, our relationship with the local. And of course, we have the acceleration of AI and robotics and the kind of technocratic paradigm that both Pope Leo and Pope Francis have referred to. So there's this sense of a kind of impending power, which sort of threatens our local, our relational power. And because of the kind of politics that we've been seeing, we really have a collapse of trust in our political leaders. We're seeing more tribalism and anger among our country. And the sense of meaninglessness I've just mentioned has become a factor in what we're talking about, the quiet revival, that young people are hungry for meaning in a world that's become so like a sea of relativism. It's very difficult for them to find a purchase, some kind of security. And so many of them are looking for tradition. And this is often described as a mental health crisis, but actually it's an existential crisis. It has a spiritual root. But of course, all of this might sound to some people a bit like exaggeration. It's not really that bad, is it? You know, it's nice and peaceful outside. The hedges are clipped. Buildings are still standing. People still go to work. The thing is, it depends on where you live and who you know and what media you consume. Our media is now so fragmented that we really can be living very close by physically and actually in parallel worlds. So we've got this reality now of, unfortunately, a sense of sectarianism emerging, balkanisation in the country, with people really very polarised and alienated from each other's narratives. So I just wanted to talk a bit now about what's behind this. So the Catholic tradition, of course, helps us to read through the lens of political economy. And that's very important because this is the context in which we live and it really affects human beings and our relationship. And we can see that what's called the neoliberal political economy, which particularly has been prevalent since 1979, has regarded human beings as units of labour, which must be cheap and mobile. So because of that, manufacturing got offshored to the Far East, and because it was cheaper, obviously, But this broke the tradition of vocational jobs and all the cultural tradition that went with that. And that's much more profound than people think. It actually goes to the primal imagination. People who've lived with that inheritance for generations, suddenly it's gone. And we mustn't underestimate the impact of that. And so this, while this economic model was going on here, of course, it's also attracting workers from poorer countries to leave their families and take up low-paid jobs here that prop up Western business models. So actually, you're breaking two lots of communities. You're breaking our home communities, and you're also breaking communities from which the low-paid workers come. This was all, of course, supposed to be creating a frictionless environment for investors. It worked very well for them. They made a lot of money. But it was actually devastating for millions of relationships, not just in our country, but from around the world. I was in Doha recently and spoke to workers in the hotel and in the airport. Been away from home 7 years, 9 years, 12 years, really lonely, missing their families, sending money home. But that's the new reality. Their families now depend on, their economy now depends on somebody living in another continent. This is what our economy has become. It breaks relationships. As Pope Francis said, it's an economy that kills. And if you remember, four decades ago, or even less actually, the idea that people should have to move to find work was regarded as right wing. Remember Norman Tebbit, get on your bike?
Yes.
It was an affront to have to leave your family and to leave a settled life. But of course, this is now being rebranded as freedom. Freedom to move. And again, this breaking of relationship with place, it's led to a civic degradation on a vast scale. While some people have profited, very large numbers have suffered. And then, of course, the shift in the knowledge economy and the service economies then caused further shame. Communities that had suffered this globalisation dogma were then framed as deficient and backward. I would describe all of this as a breach of the common good. You know, if we talk about the common good as a shared life, this is no longer a shared life. And so, of course, in time, we'd see this politics of abandonment was a recipe for mass discontent. And that's what we're seeing, not just in this country, but across the West. So what's going on here? How do we make sense of this? What connects all these disparate symptoms? Well, I would say that every era is shaped by an animating idea. And the idea underpinning the era that's in the process of breaking down comes from the philosophy of liberalism, a particularly extreme strain of liberalism stemming from the idea of the unencumbered self. The unencumbered self, where freedom is understood as freedom from constraint. So freedom from the constraints of family, of country, borders, of history, from God, and from natural law. Now, of course, this ideology is inherently unstable because it goes against the grain of humanity. It's relying on a false anthropology, a desiccated, soulless conception of the human being, and this generates a false idea of freedom, and it leads to a cult of self, quite unlike our Christian Catholic anthropology, where the person is a relational being made in the image of God. So eventually, this idea liberates society from truth and from mutual responsibility. Its spirit is actually anti-human, which is why the system is now unravelling. Its relativistic and materialistic logic ultimately brings about its own destruction. And this misconception that human beings are somehow isolated individuals, rights-bearing individuals, it has led to the emergence of identity politics, this identitarian focus on race and gender, categories, the oppressor, oppressed, the forms of victimhood we see in the culture wars all stem from this idea. And of course, because it's materialistic and against the nature of human being, it has led to spiritual confusion and demoralisation. And so also this has led to a distorted meaning of social justice, which after all was originally a Catholic term. It's now completely been colonized by a progressive ideology focused upon identity and the oppressor-oppressed dynamic. So that's gone too. So all of this eats away at our shared values and it erodes our sense of citizenship. It dissolves relationship, it undermines particularity of place, and it commodifies what it means to be human. And this puts human beings and communities under great strain. It separates and divides, and it promotes an overemphasis on rights and erodes our sense of mutual responsibility. It's actually Sister Helen that pointed out to me that when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was released, originally it was rights and duties, but they couldn't agree on the duties, so they dropped them. I mean, that's quite stunning, isn't it? You think, well, what's the effect of that over how many decades? We have a culture that's dominated by rights without a concept of balance of responsibility. So we now end up with a me culture, the I this, the I that. It sounds cliche, doesn't it? But it's actually true. And this drives us to outsource more and more things that we used to do as families and communities and neighbours to the state, you know, fostering a culture of dependency and entitlement, or to the market. You know, I don't need anyone to get what I want. I can sit at home and order everything on Amazon. I don't need anybody. But this weakens civil society. And it's very widespread now. I mean, people, they say people don't open their doors now unless it's an Amazon delivery. Well, you think it's funny, but I think it's tragic. It's a kind of slavery. We end up with this list of pseudo-freedoms. You know, this system says, on condition of your compliance, you can have mobility, you can have consumer choice, you can have rights, you can have self-determination. But it's a false story of freedom. It's endlessly promoted by the principalities and powers of our age. The over-centralised technocratic state, global finance and corporations, who stand to gain so much of this and accrue more and more power. Yet it promotes this individualism that separates and divides, and it provokes this profound yearning for meaning. And I'm afraid to say that, I mean, it's pretty obvious now, but all our political parties have been colonised by this dogma. But they've become disconnected, haven't they, from realities on the ground. They've lost touch with their founding purpose. Conservatives stop conserving. Labour Party abandoned its purpose to represent human labour. Even the Greens are no longer green, we were discussing last night. There's a colonisation of this dogma across the piece. It's really striking. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. So this is kind of a hegemony, isn't it? It's a liberal, hyper-liberal hegemony of the politics of both right and the left. Although they express it in slightly different ways. There's a sort of blind spot going on. So the right attribute moral unravelling to excessive liberalism, but somehow the neoliberal economic system gets a free pass. But the left, they attribute poverty to the neoliberal economic system, but they embrace the progressive ideas of unlimited self-actualization. You know, I can remake my own body and basically become God. So both the left and the right have absorbed this liberalism in slightly different ways. They're two sides of the same coin. And of course, this anti-human philosophy has led to gross mismanagement and provoked widespread discontent. And this political upheaval that we're now living with, potentially facing the greatest realignment for 100 years. And efforts by the political overclass, an empty overclass, I would argue, to fend off this revolt, have just alienated the public further. As John Gray says, they cannot comprehend that what they termed populism is actually political blowback against the social disruption that their policies have produced. And of course, in the last few days, we've seen the beginning of this new trend of an insurgent populist politics, not only on the right, but on the left. It's identitarian, sectarian, emerging along religious lines. Fragmentation is becoming the norm. So we can see how this hyper-liberal philosophy has affected public opinion more broadly. There's no mass outrage, for example, against this profound shift in human dignity that we mentioned earlier, this extreme autonomy in terms of abortion up to full term and assisted suicide as a healthcare option, it's widely accepted. But actually, this is the logical conclusion of this animating idea. That's where it leads. So this idea of choice and rights has become hegemonic. And the idea of mutual obligation, I could make a choice about ending my life, doesn't matter, none of your business, won't affect you. This is nonsense. We know that our decisions affect each other. We are related, we are relational beings. So it's a big lie that's being sold to us here. So we find ourselves at a hinge moment in history. And the coming months and years are going to be volatile. It's not probably going to settle down anytime soon. So we've really got to get used to it. And it remains to be seen if any political leadership can deliver a social peace. So understanding this context is vital if we discern our mission in this new era. And the shape of the new era is turning out to be quite different from the old. As Lord Glassman said in a recent lecture for us, the emerging era is tragic. The previous era was procedural, legal, administrative. The new era will be political, volatile, and democratic. So a note of hope there. He sees, or he perhaps hopes for, a shift from individualism to institutions, from self-definition to the authority of tradition. He's sensing some of the things that we're seeing in the Quiet Revival, for example, and he's seeing the importance of those local institutions. So why should we focus all of this when we want to talk about our calling? Because understanding context is vital if we're to discern our mission in this era. And because despite attempts by the modern state to subordinate the church to the private realm, what goes on in society is the location of our calling. So it is of great spiritual importance that we engage. So I wanted you to get the sense of the causes of the unravelling so that you can see clearly what the antidote needs to be. I think you can see how severe the problem is and that its causes are deeply rooted in this false anthropology of the unencumbered self. And so therefore we can see that the antidote must be a relational anthropology. And we have that as a gift in our tradition. This gift has often been too well hidden or ignored or seen to be optional. Catholic social teaching has always placed great emphasis on the relational. And it's obviously not meant just for Catholics. It's meant to be a gift for all people of goodwill. So we shouldn't be keeping it to ourselves. But it has become too theoretical, abstract, distorted, oversimplified, dumbed down in some cases. You know, if you were just to take a cue from CAFOD, for example, you'd just think it would be about solidarity in the third world. You wouldn't see it as a whole world view, as a framework for good judgment. And you wouldn't understand also that it had a relational ethic deeply embedded, which needs to be in our Christian witness. And we think about our recent popes, they've all emphasised the relational from the Catholic social teaching tradition. So Pope Francis, of course, talked about the culture of encounter, on and on and on about the culture of encounter, but somehow it just gets stuck as a sort of nice rhetorical piece of language. What does it actually mean on the ground? He also talked about integral ecology, but not often that's been kind of a theoretical idea that hasn't really worked out on the ground either. People tend to focus just on the environmental and not the integral with the person. People and planets meant to be balanced. Benedict XVI, borrowing from Newman, emphasised the connection between human beings in heart speaks unto heart. I mean, that's the profoundly relational connection he's talking about there. He's saying that truth is received in relationship, and that the human being is a listener before being a speaker. That's a really simple and profound way of thinking about this, is to be in that listening posture, which opens you up to the other person. John Paul II insisted that the human person is created from love and fulfilled in communion. He said that man cannot fully find himself except through a sincere gift of himself. So they're all pulling at this profoundly relational anthropology. And now Pope Leo XIV is also saying it's through relationships that we grow. Only genuine relationships and stable connections can build good lives. So this fundamentally relational anthropology runs right throughout the Catholic social teaching tradition. And the teaching includes a series of themes that together help us generate a vision of how human beings can thrive in relationship, both in a vocational and a metaphysical sense. Of course, it starts with personhood, what it means to be a human being, a relational being with a transcendent nature. And from this flows the dignity of the person, respect for life, and the dignity of work. And then, of course, the family, often called the fundamental cell of society or the school of love. But actually, the family is a relational form in which we learn who we are, how to live with the unbidden. We don't choose our family. This is very important. It's really counter to the idea of me being in charge of the world. I'm not God. Within the family, I have to live with the people that I'm given. And that strengthens us as human beings. And then at the community and the local level, the Catholic tradition regards this layer of civil society institutions as particularly important. It calls them intermediary institutions. And each has a vocational responsibility. This is what John Paul II spoke about so much. And that means clubs, associations, businesses, schools, charities, churches, religious orders, other religious bodies. And rather than an inward orientation serving its own interests, each institution is called to an outward-facing responsibility, to live up to its unique vocation for the common good, whether it's serving great pizza or whether it's running a great fishing club. Each has its own calling, and not only to deliver for itself, but in relationship with its neighbouring institutions. So he talked about a lateral relationship, so the building of friendships between institutions and working together for the common good of the area. So it's very local, it's very grounded vision. And the local church, of course, has a special role here. It's not just like any other institution. It's part, partly of its uniqueness is to unveil the sacred, but also as an outward-facing body, proactively building relationships with other neighbouring institutions, being that leaven in society, encouraging relationship, infusing the wider community with its gifts, while also, and this is critical, the reciprocity, being open to receiving from its neighbours. So the church actually needs to get over itself and not be so ecclesial, not so centric, recognising that it also has things to learn. So that sense of reciprocity, being open, giving, being able to receive as well as give. And the local church has a particularly important calling when the local life is thin. So in a thriving small town, for example, you might have lots of nice boutiques and lots of cafes and associations, but in a poor place, you might just have a chicken shop and a betting shop. Now, in that setting, the church is particularly important as a place for enabling people to meet, a civilizing, humanizing role. And so what I've been talking about here is really a reflection of the subsidiarity principle. And of course, that underpins the entire architecture, the way of understanding society through a Catholic social teaching lens. And of course, you'll know this principle, but I'm going to say anyway, it holds that decisions should be taken closest to those they affect, and that responsibility should be taken at the appropriate level, and that no central authority should do what can be done more locally. Now, its purpose, this principle, is to empower the person to participate according to their gifts and ability. Its purpose is to uphold the integrity of the human person. So if you ever hear a government talking about having a local consultation, or we're going to include the local people, that's subsidiarity. It's not. That's a top-down interpretation. Subsidiarity arises from below. And the whole point is to uphold and enable what arises from below, not just to be benevolently including people. And its purpose is, of course, to prevent domination. It's to prevent dependency and to prevent the centralization of power. It's to enable agency. And it's to enable collective agency among human beings. What we talked about earlier, that precious moment between human beings that is the common good. And it enables responsibility to be taken locally and for power to be relationally distributed. So, for example, in a church or a religious order or a congregation, you know, clericalism, we all know, is a bit of a problem, right? And the idea of shared leadership also is a reflection of subsidiarity, of distributing leadership. And this understanding of subsidiarity also helps us to understand the purpose of the state, which is to create the conditions that allow but not seek to control, that enable families, persons and intermediary institutions to flourish within the law to fulfil their vocational responsibilities together. And of course, alongside subsidiarity is solidarity, always in partnership, these two principles, which views human beings as social beings designed to be interconnected by relationships of mutual concern and support. It's a determination to work for the good of all and of each individual. No one should be facing the struggles of life alone. And that's unfortunately what we're seeing a lot of now. You know, a single mum stuck in the flat, surrounded by unpaid bills, damp on the wall, curtains closed, probably suffering from depression, and all she gets is a transfer of cash from the welfare state. That she should be in relationship with someone. The churches should be right in that space, reaching out to people who are isolated. This is the reality of the modern state, is that it's efficient, but it's actually really inefficient because it doesn't reach people where they are. And in practice, of course, this means building trusting relationships, particularly with people who are poor, honouring their concerns, acting together. And for example, at scale, joining people together to act on, for example, issues like damp in housing or getting together to demand decent local jobs. That's what I understand solidarity to mean in practice. Then, of course, there's the option for the poor, and that also has a relational element to it. It's not immediately obvious. Yes, of course, the option for the poor often means reference to charity and to almsgiving and justice. But this other deeper meaning, I found, comes from the Bishops of South America in the Apresada document, that if we're not in relationship with people who are poor, we will get the wrong conclusions. It's actually, again, this idea of the Corinthians image of the body. If we ignore the weak and vulnerable part, the whole body becomes sick. So we actually have to pay very careful attention to the poor part of the body. And Pope Francis said that the poor have an openness to God and to others. They know their need for others that the affluent and the busy don't have or have lost or forgotten. So our relationship with the poor is actually partly in our interests. Speaking as a middle-class person, you know, most of us are here. It's something that the church needs. In fact, Pope Francis said the church needs to be evangelized by the poor. So we shouldn't get complacent and think that it's enough just to run a food bank. It's actually a problem with that service provider dynamic. There's a huge problem with it. It inadvertently encourages dependency. It alienates poor people from the middle class benevolent giver. We should be in relationship. We should have this reciprocity, this collective sense of common good together, a shared life. So you can see again how this animating idea has even affected our idea of charity. It's turned it into a transactional dynamic. So I just want to pause for a moment and just think about how this tradition is fundamentally relational. And so it becomes clearer to us why it's the antidote for our time. Now, everyone will have different expectations, different interpretations of what this might look like in practice. But let's explore some possible approaches which we might consider, especially if you're thinking about developing formation. I'm thinking about Christian witness. What does this mean for our everyday lives? What does it mean to be a Christian now in this new context? It's not good enough to think if we just do things the way we've always done it. This is a new time. You know, people call it a post-Christendom context, partly that, but also this domination of individualism, which has wrecked our society, means that we're in a new time. And of course, we see this evidence of some young people, the numbers are small, but they're significant, through the Quiet Revival research, turning to the Catholic Church, hungry for meaning, looking for tradition, perhaps to counter that progressivism, searching for some discipline to give shape to their lives. Some of them may be motivated by political reasons. Others are distressed by nihilism or loneliness, looking for belonging. But if we're to foster an authentic Christian discipleship, especially in this context of Christian nationalism, which is adopting Christianity for political reasons, then what we have to really think about carefully is a Christian witness that is shaped around an authentic relational Christian anthropology that incorporates a common good thinking approach. So there are many dimensions to this. Let me throw some ideas. We'll have a discussion afterwards. Of course, within your tradition, you'll be the experts on this, but interiority is actually, of course, fundamental. I wouldn't necessarily assume that the newcomers to Catholicism or to Christianity have really got that yet. You know, they might have come for political reasons or intellectual reasons, but teaching people to pray is actually really, really fundamental, and a daily practice perhaps of examine and lectio. But I would inject here the sense of how can we make prayer relational. So you might think about communal ways, ways of making liturgy more communal, perhaps adoration more communal. And also to inject into that mix the question, what is God doing here among us? The sense of his work, his movements among us. And also to make people aware of their gifts and skills, what they have to contribute. As we said, we need to have an outward-facing posture, oriented physically and metaphysically, grounded in our neighbourhoods. No longer is it viable, really, for the church to be inward-facing, serving its own people. We're really called to offer out, but also to be in listening mode, the attentiveness to the Holy Spirit, so we actually find out what's going on where we live, to be conscious of context. Too often, Christians carry on as if it's business as usual. We might perhaps do some walking in the area, mapping. Who do we know? Who don't we know? What institutions are in our neighbourhood? Are we in relationship with them? If not, why not? Do we know someone in our congregation who knows them? How can we be proactively relational? We might consider one-to-one conversations as a practice within our congregation, getting used to having proactive conversations. And small relational acts, and Father Sam yesterday was talking about the London Tube problem, but now we know that it's actually a much deeper problem. And so we can make intentional eye contact as a countercultural act, a simple thing to do, but actually really quite challenging for people who are not used to that. We can say hello in the street. We can refuse to use the self-checkout. I do. It takes longer. And in terms of our Christian witness, in conversation with people, we can assert, you know, a confidence about what our faith draws us to. We can say children are a gift, not a right. We can say that we are designed for relationship, that we should care for our elderly and not kill them. These are becoming, strangely, countercultural things to say. But this is part of what we need to be building up in terms of our confidence as Christians. Not a triumphalist version of being Christian, a kind of generous, capacious Christianity, but has a very clear understanding of what it means to be human being. Bear in mind that actually in this society, We have been and we are being evangelized by another belief system to become consumers and rights bearers. It's not neutral. It's not a neutral set of ideas. It comes from another animating idea. And so we have to recognize that we do things differently. And part of that is about telling the truth. Truth speech is actually a really, really powerful device. And you will often, I'm sure many of you will have felt this, the sense of self-censorship. Oh, I can't say that. That might be a bit awkward. What's going to happen if I say that? When that next happens to you, just take a little pause and think, could I just have the courage to say something that injects a note of doubt? That allows you to be in tune with your conscience. Because the more we self-censor, the worse it gets. And we may have to sacrifice some lack of safety in doing that. I think we've got to get used to being a bit uncomfortable. I also want to speak a bit about friendship. Now, friendship, not just in terms of our mates, our friends, but social friendship, civic friendship. Being intentional about reaching out, building those connections with neighbouring institutions, perhaps with unlikely people that we wouldn't normally come across. That sense of understanding that governments may not be able to fix the problem. So in the meantime, and in fact any time, and this is what subsidiarity teaches, that this is part of what we do, is we have families, we have communities, we have local relationships, we have associations, we build connections with our neighbours. And this is actually a cosmic role. There's something very profoundly human in terms of our human transcendent nature that is a resistance against the power of the overbearing state and the pervasive power of capital. We need to be identifying relational forms. Say, for example, you notice a little group in your area and you think, they actually have got a bit of energy about them. Encourage that, strengthen it, expand it, connect them with other groups. So that's that sense of trusting what people are doing. I mentioned earlier about charity, how it's morphed from the meaning of word, of course, charity means love. It's now become service provider. That's so different, isn't it? So when we read the word caritas or charity, let's try and remember actually what it's really about. And in the World Day of the Poor letters in recent years, there's been a lot said about this, that we should stop outsourcing to the state, stop outsourcing to organisations. It's personal. We should be taking this personally. And of course, giving our time, the gift of time, is so powerful. So our actions here as Christian Witness, they don't need to be a big project, don't need to be grand, we don't need funding. We can actually just start with one small step. And of course, in this new era of AI and robotics, this becomes even more important that we hold on to what it means to be human, that we make things together, we do things together, we don't just consume. So we can organise a dance, we can organise a night playing games, we can create a space, spaces for grace, in which people can come together and discover company. As you said before, no one needs to go through or should go through life alone. And many people are doing that. And people are so touched by the opportunity to tell their story, to be heard, and to be called by name. It's a very powerful thing. No idea how lonely many people are. When I speak to friends who are psychoanalysts and so on, this is what they say. The level of distress is really quite profound. So I'm going to wrap up there and just leave you with the Jeremiah quote, which everybody knows so well. But I do think it's for our time that we're not to turn in, we are to turn out, outward facing. Hard years ahead, the cavalry is not coming over the hill. It's actually up to us, and courage is required. But we have the friendship of Christ, and we're called to be pilgrims of peace. So I'll wrap up there, and let's have a discussion. Any thoughts?